A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll hear from another young person committed to expanding access to and appreciation of classical music. My guest will be John Hofmeyer, a Princeton University senior who was recently announced as one of the 2019 Rhodes Scholars. A founder of the Princeton Chamber Music Society, he intends to continue developing interdisciplinary performance opportunities to introduce more people to classical music, and we'll talk about these plans and the strides he's already made. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The Cleveland Orchestra celebrated its 100th anniversary December 11th, using its annual meeting to shine a spotlight on its 100 years of history and its current position as it looks ahead to the future. Financial challenges remain. The orchestra reported a deficit of $1.3 million for last season, which was down from $4.2 million the year earlier. The orchestra also announced that it was changing executive director André Gremillet's position to president and CEO, with Richard K. Smucker transitioning to chair of the board as part of a restructuring. This year also marked the 50th anniversary of the Blossom Music Center, the orchestra's summer festival home. Also reporting results this week was the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, which announced a sixth straight year of budget surpluses, bolstered by an increase in revenue. In a statement, the orchestra said gross ticket revenue rose 1% to $7.3 million, the fourth consecutive year of increasing ticket sales. The orchestra's finances were also buoyed by additional donor support, including a $15 million gift from the William Davidson Foundation and more than $400,000 raised at a gala to support its Classical Roots program, which provides opportunities for African Americans in classical music. Lincoln Center announced the recipients of its Emerging Artists for 2019, which provides awardees with $7,500 to support their career goals. The winners were singer and actress Michaela Bennett, a recent Juilliard graduate, Savannah Durham, an advanced student at the School of American Ballet, composer Ashley Fury, whose Filament for Trio, Orchestra, and Moving Voices was premiered at the New York Philharmonic's 2018 opening gala, actor Nadine Malouf, jazz bassist and Juilliard graduate Andea Owens, soprano Gabriela Reyes, a member of the Metropolitan Opera's Lindemann Young Artist Development Program, musician Adam Tendler, New York City Ballet soloist Sebastian Villarini-Velez, filmmaker Eduardo Williams, and violinist Shang Yu, a winner of the Yehudi Menuhin International Violin Competition. The awardees are nominated by the various resident organizations at Lincoln Center and will be honored in a ceremony in February. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. As a student at Princeton University, senior John Hofmeyer has combined his love of literature and music, finding links between them and creating performance opportunities based on literary and other scholarly themes that have opened doors for new listeners. He is a comparative literature major and is also pursuing certificates in music performance as a pianist and in Chinese language and culture. Among his initiatives was founding the Princeton Chamber Music Society. As a pianist, he was a silver medalist at the 2015 Fischoff National Chamber Music Competition and a young artist at the Southeastern Piano Festival. His efforts and aspirations to keep building these bridges to music were recently recognized when he was named among the 32 students chosen as 2019 Rhodes Scholars. At Oxford, he plans to continue exploring the interplay between music and literature and expanding access so that more people and communities can experience and enjoy musical performances. I met up with him recently on the Princeton campus as he found time in his hectic semester-end schedule to talk about his time at Princeton, the opportunities ahead, and what it means for him to be named a Rhodes Scholar.
Well, I think it was absolutely a very exciting, surreal moment. Probably the most special thing for me was actually the reaction from other finalists in my district. The thing is that while the jury had been deliberating, they finished interviews about 4 o'clock, and we didn't hear until just before 7. For the most part, we were just hanging out, talking, getting to know each other, and just, figuring out common interests, common connections. And then the thing that I felt once they announced the two names was, no kind of ill will or anything like that. Everyone was so supportive and just really kind and congratulatory. And so I think that was a really meaningful moment for me.
Now, a lot of what you'll be doing there is based or a continuation of what you've started here at Princeton. So I wanted to kind of give a little bit of background. One of those, for example, is you founded the Princeton Chamber Music Society. We'll get to that in a moment, but what are some of the things that you are hoping to do in Oxford, as a Rhodes Scholar with the opportunities you'll get?
Yeah, so I think that in terms of stuff in the vein of the Princeton Chamber Music Society, I've heard that Oxford is just a hotbed of musical activity. And so I'm really excited to just get to know other performers, other music scholars, and sort of people who are doing scholarship in the other fields that I work in, and finding ways to bring all of that together. Because I've heard that there really is a lot of opportunity open for the kind of interdisciplinary work that I'm interested in. Just for the Princeton Chamber Music Society this past weekend, we had a Schubertiad lecture concert with a number of vocalists and pianists, and we had a lecturer who's a PhD candidate in the comparative literature department. And it was about 90 minutes long, but unlike most lecture recitals, we didn't have a lecture and then the concert afterwards. It was really interspersed, and actually, the things that the lecturer was saying would go directly hand in hand with the music that was being played, and they might have the pianist or the vocalist demonstrate some. And so that kind of really getting into the potential intersections between these different fields, these different disciplines, I think is something that I've enjoyed here. And because it sort of came about later in my undergraduate career, I'm so excited now that I have a little bit more practical experience just concertizing and performing and these kinds of things. So I'm hoping to take that to Oxford and really see what I can make happen.
Well, tell us a little bit about your musical experience. How long have you been in music, and how have you seen that really expand?
I think that my experience with music absolutely shapes a lot of the philosophies that I've developed about musical accessibility and opportunity. Because, so I grew up in Florence, South Carolina, where there is no music school, no conservatory. I had a couple of really dedicated piano and violin teachers who I think sort of inspired me toward the belief that even if you don't have all of those beautiful resources, like for instance that we have here, you can still make some really cool things happen, whether it be through chamber music or through, a small orchestra or something like that. And then when I was about 15, I went off to boarding school in Massachusetts, right outside of Boston, and started going to the New England Conservatory, and really went to the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of an environment where I was getting introduced to the elite of the elite and people who'd just sort of grown up in a really intensive musical environment. And I think that that transition was very formative for me in terms of getting access to opportunities and recognizing that the vast majority of, musicians in this country, let alone, the whole world, just don't get to experience that kind of education. And I think that my feeling now and what I've, in terms of how I've reflected on that progression over the last few years, is that if there's anything that I can do to make musical education opportunities more accessible for a broader variety, broader class of people, in this country mainly, but really wherever I can, I think that would just be a really meaningful experience for me. If I can help just one other person out, then that's a success.
So how have you seen that develop in your studies here at Princeton? You're studying both music and literature. How are you pulling those together?
Okay, so I've done a couple of lecture recitals and sort of tried out the format of not just actually lecturing necessarily about the piece of music, but also, bringing some of my experiences in literature and philosophy into the interpretive process of the piece that I'm working on. As an example, I'm currently working on some notes toward a performance of the Brahms Variations and Fugue on a Theme of Handel. And part of what I want to argue with that is that this piece, which is, one of the last early piano works of Brahms before he takes a pretty big hiatus until you get to the Rhapsodies and then, much later into the Intermezzi and other late pieces, Like, I sort of see this piece as Brahms finding his own idiom for piano writing. If you look at the early sonatas, they're very symphonic in nature. You know, there's some places where it really does feel like he was just sort of thinking orchestrally and then putting it onto the piano. But through these variations, I think that he actually gets toward his own kind of language. And so then my question was, well, how does he do that? And obviously, you know, this is all speculative. There's no, you know, conclusive answer about this. But for my own part, I think that the idea that he's starting with, you know, a highly ornamented Baroque aria and then taking it through all of these transformations that, you know, bring it through classicism and sort of early romantic compositional techniques and mixing all of these together, putting them against each other in a sort of almost dialectical relationship that ultimately leads to the fugue, which is the sort of extremely formalized musical entity where the theme is a really deconstructed form of the original aria, that he is sort of working through his own compositional heritage and the different techniques and styles that he's inherited from his previous composers are starting to determine his own musical idiom. And I personally believe that that's really how any kind of artist has to find their voice. You know, it comes from understanding who your influences are, understanding what your artistic lineage is, and then grappling with that. And through that grappling, trying to find your own idiom. And I think Brahms is able to do that, to my mind, for his piano writing within this piece. And yeah.
Now, as I referenced before, you founded a few years ago Princeton Chamber Music Society. Now, as you said, there are so many opportunities. Princeton is such a musical place. Where did you find the need for that particular type of organization?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that in my first couple of years here, I really got to enjoy a lot of musical opportunities here in terms of playing in master classes, getting to work with all sorts of people who are around here playing chamber music and everything. But I think that as I got a little bit older and started talking to, you know, a number of musicians on the campus who weren't getting those opportunities, I really had to wonder, wait a second, we have all of these resources, all of these great teachers and everything, but why is it that, at least on the chamber music side of things, the vast majority of musicians are not getting a chance to play? I think I was part of another chamber music group on campus, which was just strings and piano and was working at a really high level, which was great. I really enjoyed it, and I think I learned a lot from the experience. But I started thinking, well, you know, what about the wind players and the brass players, or maybe the players who didn't have a conservatory education growing up, but who still want to play chamber music? Shouldn't they have an opportunity to do so? So that was the initial impetus behind the founding of the Chamber Music Society. But I think the fact is that it sort of went in a lot of different directions and we had to try to find a little bit more focus. So on the one hand, we do have a 100% acceptance policy. You know, no matter what background you come from, what kind of music you play, like, we will work to find you a group that you're happy with. And, you know, those groups do a wide variety of things, from just rehearsing or playing through a couple of times to performing on, like, pretty formal, high-level concerts. It's whatever the commitment is whatever they want to make out of it. But then on a different level of accessibility, we are starting to think about the fact that even within the sort of sphere of Princeton's community, there are a lot of people in the Komplett department or the German department who don't necessarily get to a lot of musical events, or who don't have an in that part of the community, or musicians who don't really go to a lot of lectures or things like that. And so we thought, well, is it possible to bring these two things together? And now a lot of work went into it, and we've had a few different types of concerts, but I think that sort of lecture concert that we did, the Schubertiad, was a culmination of a lot of thought into what kinds of interdisciplinary concert events can we put on. And I was really, you know, pleased to hear well received by both the musicians and by the scholars in the audience. And I think that was a really vindicating moment for me in realizing that people are really receptive to these kinds of events that are not specialized and not, like, you know, limited to people with expertise in a certain field, but rather try to open things up and start conversations between different parts of the university's community.
And could you give us another few examples of some of the programs that you've been able to pull together or that other people have created through that format?
Last spring, we had two concerts. One was actually our first collaboration with the German department. The German department has been very supportive about, you know, hosting different kinds of collaborations, and we'll continue with them into the future. In the spring, it was a little bit more of a potpourri German chamber music evening. But we did have a German professor who gave a talk on the relationship that he saw between German art song and broader romantic notions of subjectivity at the time, which was a fascinating article and sort of scratched the Hegel itch of a lot of the German grad students in the audience and many of us. But it was, a really well done talk, and then it was followed by a series of art songs that went from Schubert to Schumann to Strauss with three just wonderful singers. And that's how we finished the first half of the program. And that, I think that was the first moment when I saw this kind of format could work. And that was sort of limited to a smaller part of the program. So then at the end of the semester, we had a French modernism concert. And Professor Christy Wampole from the French and Italian department gave some introductory remarks that she titled Modernist Time Capsule. And she focused on the really fascinating period of overlap between the lives of the four composers that we had in the program. And this was a mix of, we had Debussy and we had some more well-known composers, but then we also had some lesser-known French modernist composers. And so looking at that period of overlap, which happened to be, I don't remember the exact dates, but around the period between the world wars, and using that as a lens through which to interpret the different sort of strands of French modernism that were at play in the concert was just, everyone thought it was a great way in. And it really, at the end of the day, I don't think takes too much to really engage a non-musical audience to welcome them into the musical world that sometimes gets cut off to non-musicians.
Mm.
And so I've personally, whenever I've given recitals, even if it's not a lecture recital, tried to give a little bit of context or, tell the audience, this is what I think you should listen for in the piece, or this is what I'm trying to highlight. And it's always been well received. So I think that has colored a lot of my performance practice, but also just my, desires and plans as a concertizer.
Well, that speaks to one of the, critical issues that particularly the classical music, but the performing arts are facing in general, and that's relevance.
Absolutely.
How do we reach new audiences? How do we break out of this box that either we've put ourselves in or other people have put us in as, quote, classical music? As a college student at this point, what's your perspective? How do you see the way classical music and the way the performances are viewed?
Yeah, that's a very tough question. I think that I'd have to contextualize my answer to that in the way in which I have been, on the one hand, part of the Princeton community and gotten to see that sort of, quote-unquote elite side of the academic sphere. And then during my freshman and sophomore years, I was traveling into Juilliard almost every weekend for piano lessons. And that was a very different kind of intensive, they're very pre-professional sphere of music making. And I think that the thing that I realized is that the people that I talk to on both ends are actually not really closed off to collaboration or to opening things up to a broader audience in any way. I think it really and truly is just sort of a matter of custom and culture. And I don't want to sound reductive about that, because changing the ways in which we perform and the ways in which we concertize is an enormous issue. That's not the kind of thing that you can change overnight or even in a few years. But I just sort of, I'm hopeful, I'll say. I think that right now it is a little bit concerning that you go to a standard classical concert and the audience is mainly of a very particular demographic that's really not reflective of the broader, American community. Even in, I'll just give another example of a concert that we've done. We hosted an outreach concert in Trenton, New Jersey last Friday, and we called it Tigers in Trenton. And in addition to the Chamber Music Society, we had the Princeton Pianist Ensemble and Princeton Bhangra, which is an Indian dance group, do about an hour-long show for these Trenton high school students, most of whom were musicians. But the thing is that even though they played instruments and they were really into music, they really, most of them had not had the chance to hear a classical concert live, just because there's this issue of accessibility, not everyone can get into New York and go to Carnegie Hall. And the things that I heard from a lot of the students were just really touching in some ways about how inspiring they felt watching some performers play at such a high level was. That whole issue of exposure really is key, because if you are exposed to performers who are working at that level and you are aware of that and you love what you do, then you'll work toward it.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, there are certain barriers of opportunity that are much harder to overcome. But I do think that just the matter of like focusing on accessibility, focusing on welcoming non-musicians and musicians who don't come from a conservatory background into the conversation about how we're performing and how we're putting on concerts is going to just like broaden the perspective of people who are planning the concerts and people who are playing in them. And I think through persistent work, that really does have the potential to change some of the deeper problems that I think we all are sort of worried about in the classical music world.
And so looking ahead, once whether you're considering doing after your time at Oxford and even beyond that, what do you see as your career?
That is also something that I am still figuring out, but I almost certainly plan on coming back to the U.S. and doing a PhD, and that'll either be in comparative literature or musicology, I think, or just music more generally, depending on the program. I think that having a longer amount of time to continue studying, to continue practicing, and sort of really honing the craft of doing the kinds of interdisciplinary things that I want to do is essential, because that's the thing, is that one thing I see in academia specifically, but also in the world more broadly, is this really specialist culture where we're all stuck in our own fields and kind of not trying to get out of that. And that has its perks. Everyone's working at a really high level, but that also means it's a little bit hard to break your way into a field. So what I've realized is that if you want to work in between fields, you've got to be really, really, you've got to try to be really good at everything that you do. And I'm certainly not there yet, so that's just one of the goals that I'll be working for in the short term. But then in addition to that, I think that I'm going to try to, as much as I can, start looking for more professional, you know, musical opportunities of getting to do lecture concerts and more like sort of open and experimental performance styles over the next few years. And in terms of longer career goals, I think that having a mix of that and of teaching and of, you know, hopefully having a home base at a university would facilitate a lot of the things that I want to do.
Circling back to the Rhodes Scholarship, what are some of the things that you'll be doing in preparation so that you can start off once you get there?
Right. I've been already trying to get in touch with some teachers across the pond and think about like musical connections that I can make, just so that I already can hit the ground running in that way. But additionally, I think that next semester, particularly because of the way the Princeton curriculum is structured, you know, you get a lot of time to focus on your thesis in senior spring. And I'm really looking forward to that as a chance to really dive into the sort of life of a researcher in a way that you don't really get to do a lot of as an undergraduate. So I think that's going to help prepare me for what's going on next year. But in addition to that, there's just sort of the continuing to practice piano, continuing to practice my languages, and just trying to make sure that I'm as prepared as I possibly can on the skill side of things, and also like planning opportunities that I can try to take advantage of while I'm there, so that once I get there, I'm not sort of scrambling to figure out what I want to do.
Well, I understand you are quite a polyglot. What languages do you speak, read, study?
So I would say, so I've studied Spanish, French, German, Chinese, and Japanese. Of those, there are varying qualities of speaking level, a lot of which has to do with just the fact that if you don't use it, you lose it. And I've really enjoyed the opportunities that Princeton has offered me through the really generous financial aid of going to study French in France and German in Germany the summers after my sophomore and junior year. Studying, I sort of like, that was something that I kind of had to justify when I was first getting into this process, because like linguistic study of, you know, studying foreign languages is not necessarily immediately relevant to a lot of the work that I want to do. But I do, on a personal level, just sort of enjoy studying languages, and I found that, you know, speaking and reading foreign languages is really, hands down, I think, the best way to get familiar with and to understand another culture. You know, there are so many like barriers and boundaries between the culture that we grow up in and the ones that we experience out in the world. And some of those are insurmountable, and we just have to accept that and try to, you know, meet each other halfway. But I do think that, you know, learning other languages has really given me the chance to experience other cultures, particularly French and German cultures, because I was over there, more from the inside in a way. And I think that the Chinese has been a little bit different for me, because actually what spurred me to want to learn Chinese was a music trip that my high school music department and orchestra had to Shanghai my senior spring of high school. At the time, I spoke absolutely no Chinese, but it was just such a wonderful experience. And in addition to just getting to perform, we also, performed with the Shanghai National Youth Choir and got to talk to a lot of Chinese students. And that was my first time abroad and my first time getting to play music in a context other than just sort of a recital very local to wherever I was living, which opened up my thoughts for what kinds of musical things I could do and also just the kinds of connections that are possible to have with other people. So that inspired my starting to learn Chinese, which I started my first semester at Princeton. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, are you then exploring, in the music world, are you exploring non-Western forms of music? And is that something, is that something you hope to bring into your studies and your presentations?
Absolutely. I think that I'm still very much a beginning student of a lot of non-Western musics, but particularly one thing I've been interested in is Beijing opera, Peking right. opera, which doesn't, it is very much an object of study, I think, in, East Asian study departments and things like that, and some music departments, but I don't think that it all really gets put into huge conversation with a lot of Western music. And as someone who comes from a Western musical perspective, I feel like I'm, naturally going to have certain, biases or discomforts or all sorts of things that I have to grapple with as I approach the music, but even the little bit that I have been working on has been really rewarding. A lot of what I've been interested in working on my thesis is the idea of the sort of song, the musical voice, as this mediator in a way between language and music. And that's very much in line with Rachel Bergman, the PhD candidate who did the Schubertiad. We've talked a lot about this. That's very much in line with what they were doing there. But I think that Peking opera offers a really interesting insight into that, because there are a lot of features of classical Chinese language and also of dialects of Chinese that have really just about disappeared that remain in the language of a lot of these operatic texts. And then in addition to that, there's some really interesting relationships between when these different sort of stylized languages are used and the kinds of music that come along with them, how you change certain vowels to be more resonant, for instance, or things like that, that I think are really interesting objects of study, particularly on the level of how do we interpret this as a literary work, how do we interpret it as a musical work, and how can these questions and their answers inform each other.
That was John Hoffmeyer, a senior at Princeton University and a 2019 Rhodes Scholar. More information on Hoffmeyer and the Princeton Chamber Music Society, which he founded, is available at PrincetonChamberMusicSociety.com. You can find a list of all 32 Rhodes Scholars at rhodesscholar.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you on Autempo every week, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to Autempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of Autempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for Autempo on our program page. Autempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.